So today what we'll do, hopefully we'd like to get this bill moving this afternoon. Amendments are coming quickly. So we'll go through what we have, maybe call up a few folks if they have their amendment at this point and hear from folks as they get their amendments. And I don't think we'll adopt anything this morning, but I think we'll hopefully be all set to go and one more round of drafting while we go to the floor and then maybe reconvene at, well, we'll see where we're at, but hopefully 11:30, if not, maybe at 1 o'clock. Open a work session on House Bill 3201, and Chris, do you want to walk us through this great, easy-to-read chart, and do people in the audience?
There should be handouts up there.
If you'd like a chart, you can follow along with us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the handout that you're referring to, Mr. Chair, is an attempt to lay out the dash amendments that we've received so far. At last count, there were 21 amendments, and we haven't received them all, so it's not a complete list, but these are the ones that we know about. And the way it's laid out, that first top block there is just what's in 3201A, so it's just a refresher that the policy that is contained in that increases the federal tax subtraction, or the active duty pay subtraction from $3,000 to $6,000 and includes income earned by employees of the military department.
Could folks, I don't want to rain on your parade out there.
Okay, go ahead, please, Chris. A $6,000 subtraction for that income as well, and it also creates the credit of up to $5,000 for the positions at the Oregon's Veterans Home, and the revenue impact there is 1.1 and 1.8. So the next block and the next page are the amendments that we know about so far. So we have the amendment, the original bill number, kind of where the policy originated, a very brief description of that policy, the effective date and the sunset dates of the policy in the particular dash amendments, and then the revenue impact for 07, 09, and 09-11. So that first page, these are the pieces that you heard on Friday. And the dash A3 was the nurse's credit for $500, and at the time, that did not have a sunset. So we requested a sunset placed on that, and we're expecting that to be the dash A20. And that doesn't change the revenue impact. The only difference between those two is the sunset date.
Okay.
And we don't have that dash A20 yet, though. The dash A4 is the one that you adopted on Friday. It removes the sunset date for the property tax exemption for summer homes on federal land. And the dash A5 is the amendment that would add egg processors to the exemption for food processing equipment. And then the dash A6 is what we've called the human capital amendment and tax credit for traded sector businesses that increase their payroll by adding at least 5 full-time employees. And the revenue impact there is $3 million in 07-09 and $7.2 million in 09-11. So that's kind of just a recap of what was discussed on Friday. And then if you turn the page over, the dash A8 is the 60-so page amendment that you have in front of you. And this is the one that this is the main amendment, and it pulls in House Bill 2211B, which is the VETC expansion, House Bill 2212A, which is the RETC expansion, House Bill 2172B, which is it relates to two credits. There's a new credit for the repower or retrofit of older diesel truck engines, and it extends the sunset date on the credit for the purchase of new diesel engines. Senate Bill 635, which increases the credit limit on certifications for contributions to the Oregon Production Investment Fund from $1 million to $5 million. And then 984 with the dash B4 amendment, which increases the total limit on credits for affordable housing to $13 million. When that had passed out of the Senate committee last month, the limit had not been increased, so it was a revenue impact of zero. And the way it's drafted in here, that limit is increased from $11 million to $13 million, and so we see a revenue impact of $1.3 million in 07-09 and $3.1 million in 09-11.
And so when we amended the definition, and I don't know if someone's here from the mobile home community that is lobbying their package. I don't see. Paul, we should bring someone just, or we do need to talk to them at some point about how helpful this is to go to 11 to 13 million on the mobile home, or Chris, just to get their input.
Okay. And then the last piece that's in the bill is a phase out of the personal exemption credit according to federal law that exists in 2007. Now, under existing federal law, the federal personal exemption deduction is phased out for taxpayers above a certain income level. And that federal law, as a result of some of the tax changes passed in 2001, that phase out itself is being phased out over the next few years. So in 2006 and 2007, the exemption deduction is phased out to a floor of one-third of the deduction amount. So at the federal level, it gets phased out, but taxpayers get at least one-third of their deduction amount. In 08 and 09, that phases down so they get two-thirds of it, and in 10, it actually goes away, so there is no phase-out. And in 2011, the full phase-out comes back. So at the federal level, there are all these changes occurring over the next few years. What this law does is it ties to 2007 and keeps that consistent. So taxpayers, individual taxpayers above about $150,000 and joint taxpayers above about $230,000 would face a reduced exemption credit amount. But they would get at least one-third of the amount that they would claim. And those threshold amounts are indexed to inflation.
So we just paused for questions if you're going to move on. So any questions on so we would link to the 2007 federal definition of the personal exemption.
So again, those numbers, 120 and 230?
159 is the number.
If you turn to page 1661 of the dash amendments, dash 8, they're listed there. And so on page 60, line 30, so for 2007, individuals with a federal AGI of at least $234,600 would start to face a reduced exemption credit amount. And the way that is phased out is that for each $2,500 of AGI, they lose 2% of that amount, of the exemption credit amount. So by the time they get to an income of over the course of about $120,000. So between $234,000 and $356,000, that exemption credit amount is phased down.
And this is joint filers.
This is joint filers. But it hits a floor. It doesn't phase out to zero. It phases down to one-third of the amount that other taxpayers can claim, taxpayers below that income level. And then on page 61 are the income threshold amounts for other kinds of filers, mm-hmm. in lines 2 through 4. So head of household, it would start to phase out at $195,000. Individuals, about $156,000. And married filing separate, $117,000. And it would be over the course of $120,000 that it would be phasing down. And then it hits a floor.
Good. And this is just tied to the federal definition. So we get this from the federal definition.
That's where those amounts came from, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes. And the rate at which it gets phased down is also federal law, as well as that floor. And so that would take effect on January 1, 2007. Now, there are a couple of changes that need to be made in the dash 8s with respect to references. So that's the amendment we have, Mr. Chair. Would you like to go through that in more detail, or is that high level?
What I'd like to do there's three items in there. Howard and Steve Oster, do you want to come up and talk about your portion of the film and video? And then, Steve, do you want to come on up and just address the film and video portion, since it's been about 2.5 months since we've last discuss that portion?
And I need to describe the splitting.
What's the splitting?
635 and 2172. Remember the problem on Friday? Only the credit portions made it into this bill.
Oh, okay.
So I need to describe that too.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Or we're good.
For the record, I'm Steve Oster, the director of the Oregon Film and Video Office.
Your sidekick.
My counterpart.
Excuse me. Since it's film and video, we'll say sidekick.
Perfect.
So just briefly refresh us on the structure and mainly if you could focus on the economic return. As we score these, as you know, we only can score the negative portion.
Right.
But I think you would argue that this is structured in a manner that ought to guarantee some economic activity comes to the state.
Right. We've had basically, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've had 2 years with this program thus far. The Oregon Production Investment Fund is funded at $1 million in tax credits per year currently. In those 2 years, what we've seen with those $2 million in tax credits, we've seen $37 million in production business that we were able to bring into the state or keep in the state, which in turn brought approximately $74 million in economic impact. That in return, based on the Echo Northwest study of the revenue flow back into the state treasury per $1 million of production, brought approximately $2.3 million in taxes back into the treasury. So $2 million outflow in tax credits, bringing $2.3 million back in. We are, right now with those first 2 years, we have basically been operating without an incentive because we've gotten enough production coming in within the first 4 to 5 months that those are basically all committed. So we operate for the remaining half of the year without an incentive program available and consequently have wound up with folks coming in and saying, hey, we'd like to bring a film here. Do you have a incentive? Because they have to answer to their money folks. And when we say no, but can you come see us next year, that's business that we've lost out the door.
Senator George.
Would there be any reason to expect that if it did get to $10 million in the biennium that, in fact, it wouldn't yield the same ratio that it did with the $2 million where you got $2.3 million back in taxes?
Senator George, members of the committee, it's a possibility, yes. Right now we have a $250,000 per project cap. So some projects do spend above what they would have been able to have received on that. I wouldn't expect that number would come down significantly. In a worst-case scenario, I think we would be in an even situation in terms of money out the door what comes back in. In the meantime, what we would be experiencing is the jobs that come with that and the economic development as well.
And how can one be sure that many of these films that have come to Oregon in the last few years wouldn't be here without this tax credit?
Well, a good example of that would be a project that we wanted to have come here, but we didn't have anything available for them, and that would be the Kevin Costner project, Mr. Brooks, which just came out in theaters. Takes place in Portland. They wanted to bring it here. They had a great experience previously. We weren't able to offer them anything in terms of a competitive incentive. Project was shot in Shreveport, Louisiana. We've got about a day of second unit establishing shots. That was what we got here in the state for that. So they just signed for a third project with the state of New Mexico, again, because our incentive program isn't something that's competitive. We have to the north as well. Washington State just started an incentive program at 20%. Ours is at 10%, and that's part of what this addresses as well, is to kind of allow us to stay competitive. So we have, in our neighbors to the north, a direct competitor in terms of bringing business here on the West Coast.
And if we pass this. Will we be? I just remember the chart from a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Recollection, if it is correct.
I have a copy of it if you want to take a look at it.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful just so that we know where we would stack up with other states' incentive on film and video. Howard, you're not allowed to hand us It's our one day that we get to, like, you know, have things handed.
Basically, at the bottom of that, you'll see a chart there. You know, as I say, Washington State is at 20%, New Mexico is at 25%, South Carolina just started a program that goes all the way up to 30%. What we're proposing with this is to take our 10% and in goods and services only, move that to 20%, leave payroll at 10% because that goes in combination with the Greenlight Oregon program for a total of 16.2%. All of the feedback that we have gotten in the industry, we just got done at the beginning of April with a it's called a locations expo. Basically, everybody comes to all the states, all the countries come to show off what they have, all the studios come. When we discussed this program with folks, their response was, well, that's very competitive. So there are a lot of other things other than going direct percentage to percentage that we have advantages here. No sales tax, for example, being on the West Coast. All of those things work in our favor. But at 10%, we're not even able to get the conversation started. It's a non-starter.
Great. Questions for the Office of Film and Video?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
And what's the cost on this one?
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, the estimate on this is a 5.9 for the next biennium, moving to 8 million in the 09-11.
Got it. Okay. Right in front of me. Thank you.
All right. A lot of paper. Other questions for Howard Levine or Steve Oster? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Other questions on that A8 amendment from the Betsy through the affordable housing and then the exemption credit?
Mr. Chair, is it your goal that the amount of revenue raised there in the freezing the personal exemption be equal to the total aggregate of the credits that we allow?
Yeah, we need to eat up, and that 16 that I showed folks on Friday, and Paul or Chris, when they reworked the numbers over the weekend, it came to 18.9. So that's where you see an increase from 16 to 18.9. But we need to eat up that revenue so that this is a revenue losing bill at the end of the day. So we can do the math in our heads as we work through the different credits that were.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Burdick.
You said revenue losing. I thought you wanted revenue neutral.
The goal would be at the end to actually lose revenue after we do do all the components of the bill.
And how much?
Well, we're still working on what that final figure is, but we have a certain amount allocated to us for tax credits, so we have a good margin to work with. We're coming in lower than that margin significantly at this point.
So, Mr. Chair, again, clarification. If we grant greater tax credits than the revenue we're raising, then we're within the law. If the tax credits we granted were less than the revenue we were raising, then it should begin in the House. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's my understanding as well. Thank you.
Other questions on the A8s? And Chris, I know you needed to add a couple other things.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just wanted to touch on both House Bill 2172B and Senate Bill 635. Most of the other bills were essentially placed. The amendment is the other bill, and they're being pulled into this bill, and they're able to do that because of the relating to clause. With these two bills, each of them makes a number of other policy changes that aren't related to taxation. So, for example, 635, the part that pertains to the credit is in the amendment and would make it into is part of the dash eights. The other part would still be in 635. So if the committee wanted to move forward with that policy in whole, an amended version of 635 would need to be passed. And that dealt with the reimbursement pieces that Steve Oster mentioned. And House Bill 2172, it's a similar situation. There are a number of policy changes within that bill There's a clean diesel fund that's created, and all of that doesn't fit within a relating to taxation. So the only part that is in the dash 8 is the credit piece. The rest of it would be in, would remain in 2172, and then the committee, would need, if so desired, would need to pass that out to get the full policy. So basically, you had the policy that was wrapped up in each of those two bills. It's being split. Part of it is making it into this bill, the credit part, and then part of it would be standalone in the original bill. Now, in talking to Ledge Council this morning about 2172, they're still researching this, but it is so intertwined that they can't really split out all of the pieces, so it's not a clean separation into two mutually exclusive language changes. So what they're thinking at this point would need to be done is that the credit piece can stay in the dash A8, but 2172, as it exists, would need to be passed also.
So can we, I just think for simplicity's sake, do folks understand, so on the diesel, there's all this policy language that was put in there, plus the tax credit. And I think we should just put the whole thing in this bill, as long as Legislative Council tells us we can.
Mr. Chair, that's what they said they can't do. That was the original intent. But for all of the non-taxation policies in 2172, those cannot go into a dash A8. They cannot be amended into 3201.
But the tax credit could be repeated in 2172. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Senator. So essentially, if the committee wanted to move that full policy forward, you'd have the credit existing in two places, in the dash A8 as well as in 2172.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be resolved when gets drafted. I mean, you wouldn't be creating two credits.
Two of the same credits.
Right. It would be duplicative language.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the way 2172 is structured in the policy with respect to this diesel engine fund and how it's tied to the credit, it's very intertwined. And so when I spoke to Ledge Council this morning, that's the direction they were thinking the committee would need to go. And again, they're currently discussing it with the conflict amendment folks.
Okay. So questions on the A, Senator Monroe.
So we would pass... we would include the diesel credit in our omnibus bill and also pass the subsequent bill, 2172, and then if for some reason 2172 failed, the credit would still be there. Is that right?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay.
Other questions on the A8s? Okay. Let's, Representative Gilliam, I know you're here for the... You want to come up and do it now? Please. You haven't... And I don't, if you want to bring your team up with you, or...
Yeah. John could come up. That'd be great.
How was your weekend?
It was fine. I hope yours was good.
It was great.
My children deserted me. I sobbed all Sunday, but they went to Disneyland.
Oh, my gosh. This is kind of like Disneyland. for people who really don't have much of a life, it's...
Oh, Uncle Walt, thanks for having me this morning. Shall I start?
Please.
For the record, my name is Vic Gilliam. I'm state representative from Silverton, District 18. And it's my pleasure to address you today about the all-important egg bill once again. I am not certain, Senators, why we're still here doing this, but we are, and I'm excited to tell you that we have a new amendment. I know you can't wait to read another. This one is the A15s, and I think we have nailed down the latest sort of tempest in a teapot to make this thing go forward. I want not to try to understand how these things fall apart, but rather focus your attention on why this is a good idea, because I think that's something that's appropriate for our state and our counties and certainly for my district. This amendment has almost no, if none, of a fiscal implication. We estimated it might be around $7,500, but when they did the analysis, it was so nominal that they ended up with a projection of zero. What it does do is allow us to create some jobs, and I think that's the important thing here. I'm excited about this because it's in my district, but I'm excited about it because when I went and toured, I got to know the family of several generations that have had this company, Willamette Egg. There are three egg producers in the state. The one I'm, of course, interested in is Willamette Egg. But and how they treat their employees. There's very low turnover. I wish we could all drive the 20 minutes over there to see how clean the place is and how well they treat their employees. There's a precedent for this in the past. When they buy expensive machinery from Scandinavia that sorts these eggs, they create jobs. And I would like to prove that again. I'd also like to say that rather than opening Pandora's box for all kinds of folks lining up for tax credits in this committee, this is a very small example of something in a very tough time that we could do to prove that small investments by way of a tax exemption create jobs. And I want to point out one other point here. When they bring in this machinery and build the buildings that it takes to house them, there will be more property tax for Clackamas County. And this is, I think, the wisdom that the county saw. I want to be very sensitive to the case, to the shape that our counties are in as it relates to timber receipts. But rather than thinking of this as an exception, won't you please do this for my little egg processor? Let's do this as an example of being, if we don't want to be penny wise and pound foolish, let's do this. Clackamas County promised that they would support this, and I believe you might have heard from them this weekend. And I promise you, when we come back in 2 years, we'll take a very hard look at this. And I believe we'll see that Clackamas County's receipts went up and that jobs were created. Family wage jobs that are good jobs and that will stick around in Marion County and in Clackamas County. Most of the workers come from Marion County. The plant is actually in Clackamas. So I appeal to you to actually spend a little and get a lot, not just make an exception for my district. And I feel very good about the support that Clackamas County is giving us, and I am eager to answer any questions. And I don't mean this as a threat, but I just want to remind you Friday of Senator George's admonition that the egg jokes could start flying, and I have used none this morning. And I will hold restraint if you'll take a positive look at this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can't imagine how much of an incentive that is, that we have no more of those egg jokes. That is a very powerful. Questions for Representative Gilliam?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I did hear from Commissioner Kenner, a longtime friend of mine, indicated that he supported your effort.
Thank you, Senator. It is not easy for them, but I do believe that they see the wisdom and they made a commitment to this bill long ago. I just would quickly add that I did make a huge freshman mistake, and it will, I'm sure, be the last. And I tagged onto another bill. And the folks that allowed me to do that have also been gracious enough to let me off because they've read this session and realized that crackers and milk are not in our future. And that's why you see a clean egg bill. That wasn't an egg joke. It's just a very clean bill.
Crackers and milk. Are we in possession of that? I don't have the dash A15s in front of me. Seems like you're... Okay, we... has anyone been to the Capitol before?
My friend was trained in the Carter administration, which is true. That's where I met John in Washington, D.C.
Any other questions? So it looks like we have the A-15s. We do appreciate your work on this and the testimony that you provided. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Right. And I'll just wait here till you vote.
That did it.
Could you just wait over there by the...
We're going now.
Oh, I tell you, the kid's all right.
I'll just wait here till you vote. Haven't had that one before. We'll just wait until you see your vote.
Close to John Lim.
Okay, let's move to the... to the inheritance tax portion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is one that the dash A12s, and well, the policy excludes, it's what you heard in, or it's what was contained in House Bill 3479, and it excludes natural resource property and property used in commercial fishing from the gross estate value for the purposes of the inheritance tax. And the expected revenue impact there is about $1 million per biennium. This same policy was drafted in the A-12 and A-13, but it did not contain a sunset date. The A-17 is, again, the same policy. The only change there is a sunset date of 1/1/2012. And with respect to this, it would be for decedents who die before that date. Now, I don't know if we have a copy of the A-17s yet. They were on the way, so I don't know if the committee has received those yet.
We do have them. So we're getting. Thank you, Council. It seems like you are turning around amendments quick. Okay, questions on the A-17s of House Bill 3479?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick and then Senator Monroe.
You are considering the 17s and not the 12s or 13s. Is that correct?
Right now we're looking at the 17s.
Natural resource property would include what?
Well, and Don Schellenberg wanted. Jeff, do you want to come up? And Don, do you want to? You had to ask. Is he out there?
Was.
He'd asked to testify on this bill. Yes, Jeff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. Mainly illiquid assets. If you think of tractors, equipment, the land holdings themselves and the value of the nursery stock, in my case, would be all things that would be counted when we pass from one generation to the next. So that's been the primary driver for the reason for this amendment, is because what our growers are finding is if their father or mother should pass away, they have to cut or sell part of their land in order to pay for the inheritance tax that is due. And so that's the reason that we are grateful that this amendment is before you today.
So, Mr. Chair,
no one around.
Would not include land, would not include buildings.
Well, I think it would include buildings because it would be anything that's illiquid. I mean, it would, the problem with the inheritance tax and the purpose for growers is that you have a whole set of crops that have been on a massive amount of land, and you rotate the crops. And what you're forced to do in case of an untimely death of the person who owns it, and it's going to be passed on to the son or daughter, so you're having to pull that stock out or sell part of it. Yeah.
Jeff, I understand that. I'm trying to nail this down. It does not include land, right? In the case of forest lands, it would include the trees that are on the land, but not the land?
Mr. Chair, that is my understanding, but I...
Okay, and in the case of, let's say, a farmstead, would it include the home on the farmstead?
I'll have to double-check that for you, Senator Monroe.
And we'll have a couple hours to scrub that. If LRO is nodding, they'll help you scrub that. Other questions for Jeff Stone?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, according to this, it looks like it includes real property.
Yeah.
That would be my understanding, as it would.
Yeah. I was glancing at this down and trying to make sure I answered your question accurately, and it does include real property.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Could I ask our committee assistant Chris here why the revenue impact is only $1 million? Because it seems like we're talking some pretty big bucks here for this exemption.
Want to talk more?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
Since we have a little break, a little delay here, we have the $19 million that is in the personal exemption phase out. We were talking previously of $9 to $12 million. Are we going to add those two numbers together? Is that the number we're looking at?
Yeah. We are, although we're still trying to keep in good concert with the Ways and Means folks mm-hmm. on what are our last-minute budget adds. But, so yes, we're working off of roughly nine, a little less than that, at least at this point. Yeah. And then you could add the what we thought of, at least Friday, was a 16-figure, and then trying to
So what I did is I put 19 up here with 9 to 12. So it's going to probably be the 9 plus this 18.9 or 19.
Yeah, and but look, if you could give me a okay. couple hours to check in and make sure none of that got spent over the weekend, to what the size of our package of tax credits is. Other questions for Mr. Stone on the inheritance tax? Great, and we'll get the questions answered that Senator Burdick. So we'll allow the pause that we have here for a couple hours to allow Senator Monroe and Senator Burdick to get their questions answered.
And I'll make sure to get that.
Great. If you see Don, we did. The opportunity was there to go into testify and support. Okay, let's go down to the A-19s.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is one that we don't have the amendment back yet, but what the policy would be is what was in House Bill 3197, and it would create a one-time tax credit of $2,500 for medical providers that accept TRICARE. So the first year that they accept TRICARE patients, they would get a $2,500 credit. And then each subsequent year that they participate in the program, they would get a $1,000 credit. What is typed there is actually incorrect pertaining to the at least 10 care TRICARE patients. What the bill does is it focuses on the frontier counties, and so there is no minimum patient requirement. It also creates a two-year subtraction. It also creates a two-year subtraction for the payments received from TRICARE. And again, that's focused on the rural counties, and so the revenue impact is about $500,000 per biennium.
And any questions on the A-19s? And I don't know if we have someone here who wants to... Do you want to testify briefly to them?
Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Come on,
I'd like to be reminded what TRICARE is. I know it pertains to our National Guard folks. But
and we have not. This is not in the core 3201, so you have not been. No one's testified to this previously.
Thank you. You make me feel better.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. TRICARE is a federal insurance, health insurance program that is offered to all service members when they deploy on active duty. The Congress has changed the law, and they're going to allow all Guard and reservists to purchase TRICARE health insurance for $500-$600 annually. We have 8,250 Oregon Guardsmen in the state of Oregon. There's additionally probably another 3,000, 2,500 to 3,000 reservists. So suddenly we've got 10,000 patients plus families who are going to be eligible for this managed care system. And currently we are extremely put against to the wall to find physicians who will offer service to these people. And those are for the folks that are deployed and their families that are actually overseas right now. Give you an example, the only OBGYN in the state that takes TRICARE is here in Salem, which obviously is a problem. The problem is really a federal problem with respect to the reimbursement, because reimbursement's tied to the Medicare and Medicaid rate. And since Oregon is punished for being efficient in the Medicare and Medicaid business, then that transfers over to this problem. We have been able to work around it primarily through some creativity and working directly with hospitals and doctors to get minimal care up to this point. But when this new law goes into effect in October and we add an additional 9,000 patients plus families, whatever that equates to, probably close to 20,000, particularly in the rural counties, for instance, we have like one provider in Union County, none in Wallowa County, none in Grant County. And so we're trying to, the whole idea was working with the Oregon War Veterans Association, which is Greg Warnock to my right, who worked on this with TRICARE and TriWest to come up with some sort of incentive that we hope will incentivize doctors and healthcare providers to get involved and to take this coverage so we can get these people healthcare. And particularly in rural counties, most of our soldiers, they're not covered under any policy right now. Most of those type of jobs left when the mills closed down and changed and morphed in the in our economy in the last 15 years. So I think this is a good piece of public policy to try to assist these people getting health care, and I think it benefits us all greatly in at the end of the day. So that would be my plea for this this piece of the amendment, and I'll leave it to Mr. Warnock to add what I didn't.
For the record, Greg Warnock, Oregon War Veterans Association, and just for the record, the original bills are our bills, and we'd like to thank everybody here for joining us on this particular bill. And in the future, we'll probably write a similar bill each session so everybody can join us then, too. General Caldwell covered this well. The addition that I'd like to make is most of the people who will be insured under TRICARE are either underinsured or non-insured. So this is really providing a good program for people that don't have health care insurance. And this incentive, we've verified with physicians all across Oregon that this incentive is enough for them to jump on board and begin to take very low payments for their medical service. And many of them would like to do that just simply out of their patriotic duty, but frankly can't afford to add a large number of patients that they receive Medicare payments for. And so this incentive will help them to sign on to the program. And we hope that that at least this portion of the bill will continue to pass on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick. Do people who have other sources of insurance generally not get TRICARE?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, traditionally that's the case. They elect not to use TRICARE because it's hard to find people that will take it, frankly, and get paid for it. So, and the legislature back in 2005, and again, well, maybe 2003 and 2005, made corrections in how we treat state employees over this very issue. If you'll recall, we actually allow state employees that are mobilized now to stay on health care and allowed other public bodies in the state to subsidize that health care insurance while these people are deployed. And it all was based on this continual problem with getting health care for these soldiers and their families while they're deployed. So the legislature is on record of doing that previously to try to enhance, you know, for what they could reach out and touch with state employees and offer counties and cities to do the same or subdivisions. So this is another step in that direction. We would, and we know that a lot of our state employees during these deployments, they never left their Blue Cross Blue Shield or Kaiser or whatever they were on. They stayed on it because they knew they could get good care. And they didn't want to test this system because they'd heard all the problems with it. I will say that the current contractor, TriWest, has done an outstanding job of doing a better job of making payments. They're like 99% payments within 30 days of getting the bills in. Mm-hmm. The previous contractor was terrible. Sometimes they wouldn't get paid for 6-7 months. And so that really put a black eye on this program generally across the nation. So this company is doing a great job, and we're real tickled with the work that they've done, and we're trying to build some confidence back in the medical community. Even though it's low pay, you're going to get it quick. So,
Mr. Chair, is this a national contractor?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, it is. It's across the board. And we've asked, when Senator Wyden and Representative Hooley held hearings earlier, one in this building, one up in Portland earlier in the year, this was the primary issue that came up of all the soldiers and their families, was this, the health insurance issue. They're both working, trying to manage it better at the federal level. They've introduced legislation to take the highest reimbursement rate, whatever it is in the country, and whatever that is, TRICARE gets it, you know, nationwide. If we can get that done, I think that'll help us also incentivize doctors and medical providers to take this form of insurance and provide the coverage.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we'd like you to know also is that this program, if we can pass this in Oregon, we will take this to all of the western states and present a bill to each of the other western states to do something similar. So this really is a testing ground for the TRICARE tax credit, And like I said, if we can get it here, we will affect then millions of lives, not just the citizens of Oregon.
And it is fair to say, I mean, what initially got me interested in this is it's fair to say this is a trial program to see if we can't get at a problem that is out there in terms of soldiers not getting health care and see if this incentive actually makes a difference.
Correct. Yeah, we would want to monitor it and see where we're at and come back probably in 2 years and say, this is what we know now has occurred since we did this or what didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Because we're shooting in the dark. We're building this bike while we ride it. Mm-hmm. And it's been difficult.
Mr. Chair, also the bill now currently, the way it's written, the amendment is to help the rural counties, but the initial bill was to help all of Oregon's counties, because one of the problems we've had, like General Caldwell said, the only OBGYN doctor that's in the TRICARE system is here in Salem. So all of the OBGYN doctors in Portland that aren't signed up on this, there is no current incentive for them to sign into this. So in a couple of years, if this is working in the rural counties, we'll probably bring this back for the metropolitan counties as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So what we have here is a situation where the federal government is providing inadequate health care coverage for the men and women that are putting their lives on the line and their families. And we as a state are going to be required, and I will support it, to subsidize that because the federal government has provided inadequate coverage that is so bad that the doctors won't even, and doctors and nurses won't even accept it.
Senator, or Mr. Chair, Senator, the part of the problem is the TRICARE program is based on the Medicare-Medicaid payment system, and Oregon has a lower payment than some of the other states. So states that have the higher payment don't have the same difficulties that we do here in Oregon. Just for the record, we are working with members of Congress to fix that and to stabilize the payment schedule nationally and equalize that. As that happens, then that will add an additional incentive to physicians to sign up for this. But keep in mind, this is the only medical program for the families of troops, of military. It's the national program for health care.
But to answer your question, yes.
And we would appreciate your help, too.
You'll have it.
Yeah, and I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, if you look at the whole context of how the federal government, now the Army and the Pentagon, looked at mobilizing people, which was basically a World War II construct. Mm-hmm. And it hadn't changed since World War II in any great shapes or forms. And so mobilization became kind of a surprise to them when the amount of soldiers needed to be mobilized for this particular efforts we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they were basically behind the power curve. They didn't have a system that worked. And this system was based on military medical treatment facilities. The nearest one to Oregon is Fort Lewis. So if you're at Fort Lewis or you're in and around Fort Lewis, you can take your TRICARE, you can go in and get this treatment from an Army hospital, per se, military hospital. Can't do that in Oregon. Can't do that in Idaho. Can't do that in Montana. Can't do it in a lot of places. So they based it on a very, stupid rule, if you really look at it, but that's kind of how it all generated. And percentage-wise, it takes care of a good deal of number of the citizen soldiers that are being deployed because of the nature of where the forts are, not on the West Coast and certainly not in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I'm really glad to hear that our congressional delegation, I know them all, they're good people, are fighting to try and improve the situation here.
Mr. Chair, one last thing. While I'm here, worked with Representative Barnhart when House Bill 3201 first came to the Revenue Committee, and he brought our attention or brought this whole bill concept into play as a taxation bill. We have several other bills that we were hoping to put back into this as well, and they'll be given to you in the form of amendments also. So we'll get those shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, General Caldwell. Okay, so the last one that we have, and then we'll pause, is the A21s, another issue that we have yet to vet. As the state treasurer here, Michael, Michael Parker, and Chris, do you want to?
Sure, Mr. Chair, very briefly, what 2462 does, it increases the subtraction for contributions to the Oregon College Savings Network. Right now, under current law, that it's $2,000. for all filers except married filing separately, where it's $1,000. What the bill would do would, for joint filers, increase that amount from $2,000 to $4,000, and for married filing separately from $1,000 to $2,000. For single filers, it would stay at $2,000. So it addresses, in some respect, the so-called marriage penalty aspect of that. The other piece that's not in 2462, but is part, should be part of the 821 amendment, is that those amounts would be indexed to inflation. And so the revenue impact there is $2 million and $3.2
million. Michael Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. I'm just going to kind of go over this testimony really briefly and then be happy to answer questions if the committee has questions about the program, and give you a little bit of history and then kind of what we want to do with the amendments issued in 2462. So as many of you probably know, the state of Oregon began offering these plans back in 2001. Because they're so, the popularity grew so much, we actually expanded the program over the years and now offer three college savings programs to the people in the state. The Oregon College Savings Plan, which is probably the one you hear about the most, that's our flagship program. That's the one that we sell directly to consumers that you'll hear about on TV and on the radio and the newspaper. The network offers significant state and federal tax advantages, as staff had mentioned. In addition to the deduction, which we're here to talk about today in the proposed amendments to 3201, all earnings are free from federal and state taxes. So as you put the money in, it all grows federally and state tax-free. It can be withdrawn state and federally tax-free if used for basic college expenses. It can be used for a broad range of expenses, room, board, tuition, books, fees, basically any expense that's related to going to college you can use this money for. And you can use it at pretty much any eligible university or community college, technical schools, training schools, any program that participates in the federal financial aid program, you can use 529 program assets for. To give you some idea of what we have invested in the state currently, our program currently exceeds $900 million in invested assets, and 6% of those assets are invested by Oregon residents. So we sell our plan nationally, but folks in Oregon really responded, and most of our assets are Oregon assets. And to give you an idea of nationally what you're looking at nationally, this is a $100 billion industry nationally, and more than 10,000 beneficiaries participate in this program nationally. An increase in deduction would greatly improve the Oregon College Savings Program here in Oregon, which now helps about 50,000 Oregon families in Oregon. We have more than 50,000 accounts, but we have about 50,000 beneficiaries in Oregon. The deduction, really, what we're targeting here is those middle-income Oregonians, two-parent families that likely do not qualify for any grants or special kind of loan programs. On average, these families are earning between $40,000 and $80,000 a year, so they're both working parents, have two or three kids. They do not qualify for many grants. This is what this program really targets. This is what this deduction really targets. It isn't for high-income, really for high-income Oregonians, it's really that middle-class section. So increasing the deduction really leverages the amount that Oregonians will invest privately in this program. So for an additional $2 or $3 million in investment by the state, we can likely leverage in the 07-09 biennium about $400 million in private contribution. Right now we do about $150 million in private contribution. We think that will double over the 07-09 biennium with an increase in the state tax deduction.
And so what do you base that on? I've seen that figure before.
We went back and looked at some analysis of what we're taking in on a $2,000 basis, and just have come a hair shy of doubling that. We did some research, and most folks say they put up to the amount of the deduction in. So if it's a $2,000 deduction, they're going to put $2,000 in. We asked them, would you put more in if, in fact, we raise the deduction? And the answer was yes, we would double that amount we put in. So we have research and just anecdotally evidence that the deduction would, the contribution amount would double over time if you raise the deduction.
And who conducted the research?
I believe Grove Insight. Lisa Grove conducted the research.
Did the research.
Yeah. Just quickly, I'll finish up here. Also, the small increase in the deduction also gives families, it's a meaningful incentive. Many folks will likely not save for college without an incentive. They have the means, they have the money, they're just not going to do it without a tax break. And this gives them the incentive to put money in for college. What I want to also address here just briefly is this bill does not address those families with multiple kids. So really, the $4,000 deduction is really based on having families with one child. This does not address families with multiple kids. I mean, it does, but it's not as meaningful for families who have two, three, four kids. Currently, one-third of our participants in our program have more than one child. So that's something to consider as we move forward, that it's not as meaningful for folks who have multiple kids in their family or multiple grandchildren in their family. Just to give you an idea what families need to be saving, a family with two small children need to save about $500 to $700 per month to have enough money to afford three to 4 years worth of college in 18 years. So the amount they're saving is significant. We likely tell folks that they're not going to save for 4 years of college, but get enough in there to save for 2 or 3 years and offset that cost. But the amount of savings is significant. And then give you an idea of debt loads. This is another big issue for us, is we're really wanting parents and grandparents and families not to come out with a large amount of debt like I did. I'm sure many folks here did. To give you an idea, on average, Oregon students graduating from an Oregon public university come out with $19,000 in debt. That's eighth highest in the nation. This bill, long term, I think addresses a lot of that issue, where parents and families will save and reduce that debt burden. Oftentimes, debt shoulders a student not being able to buy a car, a first home, or take the job that they want because they have to service that debt. In 2001, 49% of graduates coming out of the University of Oregon carried some amount of debt. In 2001, that number increases 60% by 2005. So the numbers are increasing, and those numbers are very typical over all of our public universities. And then also to give you an idea of the median contribution in our program, about $2,000 is invested every year by our participants. So again, that just looking at our data, about $1,975 is invested per year per contributor in our program. And I'll just finish up by just letting you know kind of what's happening nationally. Nationally, the average deduction nationally of those states that have a deduction is about $6,600. Oregon is second to the last with our current deduction. We're just ahead of Rhode Island as far as college savings deductions go. And I included in my testimony an editorial by the Register Guard that was done last week. And I'll just finish up with a quick quote there. They say that there may be a little legislature can do this year that stops tuition from rising, but it can make college easier for Oregonians to bear. The bill would encourage savings and improve access to higher education at relatively little cost to the state. And that's really what I want to leave you with. The small investment that you can make will leverage large amounts of private investment. And that's what we're looking for, that leverage aspect. It's not just a one-to-one. It's a pretty large leverage that gets folks to save for college.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I've been participating in this program for my grandson. He's almost three since he was born at the maximum. I would be interested in knowing, with the growth and interest and so on, a person contributed the current maximum, how much money would there be in 18 years? And with this new maximum, how much money would there be in 18 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, so if you want a number of $2,000 per year for 18 years and $4,000 per year for 18
right.
years.
Yeah.
Correct. There'll be an assumption of return on that, but we'll do an average return, and I'll get that right to you.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Burdick.
If someone contributes more than the tax deduction amount, is the interest in earnings still tax-free?
No.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, you can contribute more than $2,000, and everything grows state and federally tax-free and can be withdrawn state and federally tax-free. The $2,000 deduction is just what the state offers as an incentive to participants. And again, it all grows federally and state tax-free, so the $2,000 is separate from the tax-free growth. It's a double incentive.
Other questions for Michael Parker with College Savings Plan? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
If you could, the quicker the better on
I'll get right to you.
Great. Okay, so that includes, colleagues, you have an A16 in front of you that looks familiar to me and won't be familiar, I don't think, to anyone else. It's from Representative Butler. Is Art Fish here? So, Paul, to adopt the A16s, we're going to need someone. Representative Butler talked to me about them. They seem relatively administrative, but we will need someone, Paul, to come and at least brief the committee on, someone from Economic Development or Representative Butler to brief the committee on why these are perhaps a good idea. Other questions for staff? We'll rework this chart based on the conversations that we've had and return after our floor session. Okay, so we're going to pause until... What time is floor session? Did we check that out? Okay, so we will pause until 1 o'clock, and we are in recess till 1 p.m.